Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome to the program. Today's show is recorded in front of a live studio audience at the 930 Gov Conference in Washington in late August. My guest is federal CIO Tony Scott.
Let me just start with the basic question for you, because I think this is the easy one. 7 months in, how many times have you said to yourself, what did I walk into over the last 7 months? Because it has not been an easy 7 months. So give me a sense of your just first 7 months. What's the initial take been like?
It's been, for me, just absolutely a joy in a lot of ways. First of all, I think you can't help but be curious in this kind of role. How do things really work? If you're not in Washington, D.C., or a part of this ecosystem, it's really hard to understand how it works. I mean, what really happens on a day-to-day basis. So the first thing for me was just orienting myself to, you know, the White House, OMB, Washington, D.C., and as you said, kind of, you know, learning your way around a little bit. But if you're in any kind of CIO role, I don't care where you are, there's a number of topics that are going to be first and foremost on your mind. You're going to look at, you know, the people that you work with and make some assessment of that team. You're going to look at the state of technology and the applications and those kinds of things. And you're going to pay attention to cyber. So coming in, I looked at my team, pretty happy with the team I inherited, looked at the state of applications, wasn't a big surprise there in a lot of ways. And then you start looking at cyber, and like every CIO and every role I know, you go, ooh, boy, we got some work to do. And then things started happening, and so you sort of, you know, step up to the plate and start working on it. And so in a way, I wish there was a little more breathing room, but, you know, there's nothing like a crisis to sort of get the juices going and get people motivated. So I'm really proud of the work that the teams have done. I wish we had done it sooner, but, you know, at this point, we're working as hard as we can on it.
So we will definitely get into the OPM cyber breach and just the cybersecurity challenges at large. Let's squash one rumor right up front. One of the things that people have talked about is the cyber sprint, the 30-day cyber sprint. Many people like to say, oh, that's a reaction. Mm. And now I've been told, and from people close to you, I love that, people close to you, about the that this was in planning works for months before. I think probably when you first came in, you probably looked at the state of cybersecurity and said, what?
Yeah. Well, what I realized was that OMB had put out a lot of guidance over the years. In fact, none of the things that we asked agencies to do in the sprint were new topics that were things that we asked people to do for the very first time. It all had been, in one form or another, issued in the form of guidance or, you know, the various mechanisms that OMB uses. What we didn't have was, I think, any kind of good cadence and sort of a sense of urgency about that. And so even prior to OPM, I was thinking about what are the things that we could do to sort of accelerate our progress on this. And frankly, that wasn't the only topic. Our move to the cloud and some of the other things that we had issued guidance on before felt like they were languishing a little bit and maybe had lost the sense of urgency. So I've been thinking about, you know, how do we accelerate some of these things and really make a meaningful difference in a much shorter period of time?
So if you've never heard Tony speak before, and if you have, you know he brings up the great analogies. I really appreciate the landing the plane. Mm-hmm. That was one of your first ones.
Yes.
I appreciated the don't blame the firefighters for the fire.
Yeah.
I know maybe you have a great speechwriter, but I appreciate that as a way to bring it to a simple place. What's been the biggest challenge so far beyond, obviously, OPM and cybersecurity from a learning, from a CIO, you know, as you walk in the door?
Well, probably the biggest personal challenge has been the heat and humidity in Washington, D.C.
And the traffic.
Still getting used to that. When you walk out the door in the morning and you're greeted by the sauna, it's, you know, a little daunting, especially when you're wearing a tie and suit to work every day. I'd say, you know, probably the biggest professional challenge we have, and this is, I think, across the whole federal government, is finding the right skills and talented resources to go do the heavy lifting that we have to do across the board. And it's particularly acute in the cyber area. It's the hardest recruiting I've ever done, whether it was in the private sector or in the public sector. The good news is there's a lot of people who are now interested in doing good things for the country, and so we're actually getting a lot of unsolicited resumes and people who said, you know, can I come help? This seems like a really important thing, and I'd like to be a part of it, help work on it. But I think it's true across IT as well. Right now, there's a severe talent shortage in some roles across the whole IT industry, and I think we've got to do more as a federal government to recruit, retrain, build from within to get the kind of resources that we need to do this important work.
Let me pull the string on that for a second, because one of the things about the cyber, not just the cyber workforce, but the IT workforce more broadly, is something very similar happened to the acquisition workforce in the 90s across the federal government. For those of you who have been around longer than me, you know that Congress came in and said, these acquisition workers, especially at DOD, we're not sure if we need them. Let's start cutting them. And DOD was pushed to get rid of some of those acquisition workers, and then the outsourcing, and then we had the whole A76 issue, competitive sourcing. And I think this very similar thing happened to IT, where you have program people, but you don't necessarily have the technical expertise. Is that something that you, from a government-wide perspective, are looking at to say, how do we bring that technical expertise in? I mean, if we talk about digital services or 18F or the buyers clubs, that seems to be where this is heading. But is this, if instead of one-offs, is there something bigger, broader coming?
Yeah, I think it's not just a question of bringing it in. It's also developing from within. In the private sector, I would run a lot of, you know, sort of talent development and succession planning and other kinds of activities in a very structured way to make sure that we were developing the kind of talent that we needed within by giving people, you know, assignments that, you know, allowed them to grow and get multiple kinds of experiences. And then you supplement that with, you know, some percentage of people from the outside. And in government, I think we need more of that kind of sort of development. You know, there's always some balance between the individual taking personal responsibility for their own development and then the things that structurally the institution can do to help make sure that there's a good balance and the right sort of opportunities that present themselves. And so as a federal CIO, I added a fourth sort of work stream to our, you know, overall strategy in the federal CIO office. And that fourth stream was a people agenda to make sure that we were focused on the right talent, that we had the right kind of pipeline, that we had the right kind of visibility of, you know, the talent within the organization, but also the gaps that we have. And we need to figure out a strategy more broadly about how we fill those gaps over a longer period of time. So we're hard at work at that right now. And the CIO Council and I will spend a good amount of our time in September and October on that people agenda.
One of the things about the workforce that you started and the CIO Council started in early summer was the Solutions Challenge.
Yes.
And I've seen some updates come across the CIO Council. Give me some insights in terms of the projects that they all took on and how that's been working generally.
The example that you gave, the Solutions Challenge, is one of those things. And I mean, we did the Solutions Challenge with a couple of objectives in mind. The first one was we wanted to identify some of the developing talent in the agency. So each of the agencies were asked to pick people, handpick people within the agencies to be a part of that initial group. And then we got them together, and there's benefit from that peer group exchanging and getting to know each other, exchanging ideas, sharing observations, and so on. And then we asked them to pick out some big challenges that they see in the federal government IT ecosystem and then develop recommendations for those issues. And so we're getting near the end of that now. And as you say, we're pretty excited about some of the opportunities. And we'll put people to work on those ideas that we select at the end. So I don't want to pre-announce any favorites of the list because we haven't actually had the final adjudication on it.
But just between us.
But I'm very excited. I will tell you, I think the teams have done really good work, and I'm pretty excited about where this goes. And we'll use this as an opportunity to learn, and then we'll do another one, maybe with a slightly different theme, but I'm committed to making sure we're developing talent within the agency and within the federal government.
I want to go back to one thing you said, that in September, October, the CIO Council, which you lead, and your office will work on some of the workforce things. Anything you can give us a broad brush heads up on? What types of things are you doing? Are you re-looking at the 2210 series? Are you re-looking at something more specific like training? Give us a broad sense.
The look I want to have is across a couple of different dimensions. The first one is, you know, who are the folks that we think are the promising leaders, you know, they're coming through the system? And then what are the development opportunities each of those people need to round out their experience? And then once you understand what the individual needs, you can also look at what are the roles within the federal government that could satisfy those needs. And you do a little matchmaking and try to get people those experiences over time. And then, as I mentioned before, one of the things that we'll also do is we'll try to do a higher level assessment of where do we have gaps in talent. You know, I can tell you cyber is one of those areas already. This would be no surprise to anybody, where we think the just sheer number of people that we have, and this is not saying anything at all about their skills, but the sheer number of people that we have probably isn't sufficient to meet the demand today. And so then we'll also talk about different levers that we can use to bring in and develop more of that kind of talent.
We have to take a break. My guest is federal CIO Tony Scott. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest is federal CIO Tony Scott. Our discussion was recorded in front of a live studio audience at the 930 Gov conference in Washington in late August.
One of the things about the job that I love about is I get to play paparazzi to people like Tony, his colleague Ann Rung at OFPP, some folks at GSA, for example. So I got to see you speak quite often. And most recently, you spoke at a FATARA event, and you talked about O&M versus DME, a couple of my favorite acronyms, operations and maintenance spending, legacy IT versus development modernization enhancement. You maybe shocked us a little bit by saying it's back to 80%. Because for years it was down to 75%, 72%. Right. There have been surveys that have said it's coming down, it's getting better. So first of all, why do you feel like it's back to 80% based on, I guess, agency reporting? And talk a little bit about some of the plans to bring those two numbers closer together.
When I was speaking, I wasn't speaking with precision there. Just I want to make clear, because I've gotten a number of questions. You're apparently more widely read than you might believe, but it got widely reported. But my concern is that it's heading the wrong way. And this will happen naturally when you have an environment that we have where budgets are constrained, CIOs are told, cut costs, don't spend more money, and so on. And it's just a natural phenomena, and I'll explain it a little bit. Everywhere I've ever been, when the CEO or CFO or somebody comes in to an IT organization and says, we need to save money, CIOs know how to do this. They're well practiced at it. And this is a natural human reaction. They cut the easiest thing there is to cut, which is spending on new application development and refreshing infrastructure. Those are the easiest levers to pull and say, we've got to retrench. And it's really, really hard, in contrast, to cut, you know, that operational expense, the thing that keeps the lights on and so on. That's really, really hard work. And usually you don't get that much credit for it because it takes a long time. And in many cases, you need investment to actually cut the spending in the long run anyhow. So it's no surprise that in a sequestered world and so on, and where there's more demand than ever, for IT services and so on, that this trend is happening. The irony of all this is that if you actually can figure out a way to go after that O&M spending, the payoff is phenomenal. And I often use the example of Microsoft, where we got on a regular refreshment cadence, and what you realize is that every 2 years you can buy gear that's twice as powerful for the same cost or less. Everything is, in some ways, at least in the hardware and so on side, a race to the bottom in terms of efficiency and cost effectiveness and all that sort of stuff. So if you can get on that trend, you can save a whole bunch of money and use that for new application development and new business capability and so on. And so the trick is to not do the easy thing and pull that fast lever, but really to invest in, you know, regular refresh of infrastructure, regular refresh of applications, regular refresh of business capability. And if you do that, you'll do one of two things. You'll actually save more money in the long run, or you'll create dramatic increases in capacity for the same cost. And so that's the trend I want to get us on, and it's hard to do in a sort of sequestered world.
So I guess the logical follow-up is how, because this is not a new concept. As you talked earlier about cyber,
sure,
none of these things are new. Getting off of O&M and moving to DME, we've heard for the last decade plus.
Sure. Well, the words are easy to say, but until you have a operational plan that says specifically, here's what I'm going to do, it's hard to materialize. So this is landing the plane, to go back to that analogy. This is the hard work of saying, hey, we're going to have a refresh schedule for hardware that's going to be, pick a number, 3 years, 5 years. Really doesn't matter what it is, but as long as you develop a plan and get on it, you can't start realizing the benefits. If you don't regularly look at your application portfolio and say, here are the things that I'm going to do proactively to upgrade and modernize it, you won't get on that train. If you don't look at how you're running your operations or the contracts that you use to manage that O&M type spend, you won't get on that train. And so that's the activity we want the CIOs to engage in. And in some cases, it'll cost a little money to make an initial investment in that, but there's, you know, dramatic evidence. You can look around you in the private sector all over the place and see great examples of this, where once you get on it, the dividends really start to pay off.
Do you feel like the lever that OMB specifically holds is obviously the budget?
There is a budget angle to it. You've got to provide flexibility in the budget that allows people to make that investment. The 930 Gov is a great symbol of, you know, what happens in the federal government. I'm told, I haven't been here for a year end, but I'm told there's tons of year end spending because it's a use it or lose it sort of proposition. And that's just a really bad way to run IT. It's horrible. It drives exactly the wrong behavior in terms of what you'd really want. So part of, I think, what we will work on is how do we change that model so that you can either take that money that would be, I'll say, a little frivolously spent at the end of the year and make that available for seed money to start this flywheel of better investment or some other mechanism. But I think we got to figure out a way. You can't sort of sit here and responsibly watch all of this decay and feel good about it. You've got to figure out a way to do something.
I don't think a lot of the vendors like the year-end spending barrage either.
Well, they might, depending on the business.
How much they win.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll go with the first question.
Mr. Scott, Gladys Gould, the Department of State. I wanted to ask you, what new reporting requirements do you see FITARA generating out of the CIPIC process and the training requirements as well?
Well, the goal is, quite frankly, is to not generate a lot of new reporting requirements. Our goal over time is actually to reduce the amount of reporting requirements that each department does. And one of the things I've challenged my team on is for everything that we ask agencies to do, one of the things that we want to do is figure out what of that can be automated so that it doesn't require people, you know, running around with clipboards and, you know, barcode scanners and whatever to do the data collection that's, you know, required to do some of this reporting. In the immediate term, FITARA will require the submission of a plan, which have now all been done, and we're in the process of reviewing those. And then some of the data collection that we do will get modified. But the biggest challenge I've given our team is, you know, how can we reduce the data collection requirement? And I'm asking them to show me how we're using every single bit of data that we collect, because if we're not putting it to some meaningful use somehow, then I don't feel that we should even be collecting it in the first place. So hopefully, over time, that burden goes down, at least the part that's not automated, is my goal.
All right. Thank you. We got another question back there.
Good morning, Mr. Scott. My name is Angie Velasquez with Armedia, small business consulting firm. I'd like to get your thoughts on the records management directive and what would your advice be to the CIOs in managing that directive and given the budget constraints?
This is one of the fun sort of, I guess, anomalies in Washington, D.C., is that there's all kinds of directives that come sometimes with no funding to do it. You've just got to figure out how to squeeze it in. So I'm not going to advise anybody not to comply with the directive or, you know, any of that sort of stuff. There's things that we just have to do.
That'd be bad advice, by the way.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Including OMB, you know, guidance as well. But, you know, I think in every agency, and this is what part of FITARA really is, you know, the CIO is supposed to engage in a discussion with the executive leadership of that agency and prioritize the work and the portfolio and the things that that agency engages in. So records management will be one of the things on the list, and the agency with the CIO leadership conversation is going to have to figure out you know, exactly where that's going to fit in their priority. And I think most agencies are going to put it pretty high on the list, frankly. There's nobody who's going to say, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. This is sort of bad practice or something like that. So I think it's going to get actually pretty high priority from what I can tell.
Well, since it was brought up, FITARA, let's go down that path a little bit.
Yeah.
I think it's been about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, since the agency baseline assessments have come in. I know you can't talk specifics, but can you give us some general ideas of what you've seen so far?
I'm pretty pleased overall. One of the benefits of the pretty public work that we did in sharing where we were going with the FITARA guidance is that it's been out there for quite a long time. So I think when the final guidance came out, it didn't come as a surprise to anybody, which is probably a good thing. Of all the submissions that we've seen, I'd say there's none that are perfect, and you can sort of see every agency's personality show up in the plan that they've submitted. And so right now what we're doing is we're reviewing those plans. We're providing some feedback to the agencies to get more information about why they said some of the things that they've said, both positive and negative. We're seeing opportunities where our guidance could be clarified a little bit more, where there was confusion. And we've seen some great examples of agencies really taking this on and being very explicit about how they're changing their governance process and the role of the CIO in the agency. And I'd say overall, I would give it probably a B-plus in terms of the work that I've seen. So pretty good.
And going forward, I know there's another deadline coming up, I think, in December, end of the year. But between now and December, do you plan to have meetings with agencies based on that guidance they sent you, or how's that communication going to work?
Yeah, so there's informal and formal feedback that'll happen. Ultimately, this will result in OMB approval of the plan, And I think all agencies will get there. Some will get there sooner rather than others. You know, not all agencies are obviously created equal. And so that's really the next set of steps.
So when it comes to FITAR, the two things we've heard, if you remember, obviously, the Clinger-Cohen Act, the two things that fell apart was the congressional support, which we've heard many times from Congressman Connolly and others, that they're definitely going to pay attention to this one differently. But the other piece is the support by the non-IT folks, specifically around the deputy secretary, so the President's Management Council. I understand that FITAR has come up several times at that PMC meeting. Can you give us a sense of what that conversation has been about and what kind of reaction are you getting? Because, again, that level, the deputy secretary, is the one that could stop it or really give it a big push.
I felt, frankly, overwhelming support for FITAR at the PMC meetings. You know, the first couple of conversations were really more information sharing and educational. We gave the PMC sort of previews of what we were thinking about in terms of the guidance. Everybody knew about the law, but, you know, not everybody was sort of up to speed in terms of, you know, what the guidance might look like. So we shared both the process and then some of the actual content. Since then, we've had meetings with virtually every large agency and quite a few of the smaller ones where the deputy secretary, the PMC member, as you said, and the CIO and some of his or her team have met with our team and gone through in much more detail, you know, what FITAR means, what it might look like for that agency. And so it's been a great two-way sort of conversation in all the places that you would want it to take place. And a lot of good questions coming back about what it really means and how it could get implemented in a very complex agency in particular, and there are several of those. So I feel like it's been a good conversation, and everybody has pointed back to Clinger-Cohen and said, we don't want this to have the same fate. We think this is good. It's good for the agency. It's good for our mission, and it's good for the American people if we get this fixed.
But how, from an OMB perspective, do you keep a long-term view?
You know, how do you get good habits? It's practice, practice, practice. You repeat them over and over and over again. So our intent over the next 2 years is to inspect regularly and develop that muscle memory that hopefully everybody at the end of this 2 years time frame, year and a half, whatever it is, I've stopped counting, says, you know, that's good exercise. We're, you know, fit, we're in shape, and we think this is something that we should continue doing no matter who's here.
Has there been any discussion between your office and or OMB more generally and the PMC to say, we're going to hold you accountable for making this law work and work the right way? Because one of the things that I've heard from, for instance, the previous administration and Karen Evans, who was the quote-unquote federal CIO, though the Bush administration chose not to call her that, she would say, well, if you're not happy with my policy, whatever, let's go talk to Clay Johnson, who is the DDM. And Clay Johnson was known to have the ear of the president and, you know, was the roommate of President Bush at the time, you know, from college days. So, oh, no, no. And then you always heard the, well, no, I think we can do this now because they just have to want to face it. And I know talking about the carrot versus the stick is always, you know, harder for someone in your position, but do you feel like there is the hammer that you have?
Sure. You always have that option. And if people know that it's there, you know, then you don't even have to use it in a lot of cases. And I prefer to have the, you know, more friendly conversation, quite frankly. But I've had to use it, you know, from time to time in the past. And, you know, you do if you have to. But I consider it almost a failure if you have to use that. I mean, there's just a complete lack of understanding or some other problem that, you know, actually you got to go sort of figure out, and you use it as a last resort.
We have to take a break. My guest is federal CIO Tony Scott. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest is federal CIO Tony Scott. Our discussion was recorded in front of a live studio audience at the 930 Gov conference in Washington in late August.
Let's shift gears again and let's move over to cyber. I think we can't leave without that.
That's right.
It's everywhere, everything. Cyber Sprint's over. I published an article talking about some progress that, you guys made that you didn't maybe want to talk too broadly about. But it seems like things are better than they were from June, and significantly better. I'll give you one example that Tony may or not want to address, but there was a chart that talks about indicators of compromise. If you know about cybersecurity, an indicator of compromise means there's a very strong potential your network's been breached. There was, I'll just say, more than a dozen. When I talked to the unnamed government official source that I talked to, they came back and said all of them were false positives. And actually, that's a very good news story, because it means, at least to me and to the maybe a bit of a novice when it comes to cyber, things are better than maybe people thought. When you walk out of the sprint, here you are a month after it ended, do you feel like the government's in better shape? And I know it's a marathon, so no one expects it to be perfect.
Sure. Yeah, so let me talk about a couple of things there. So the things that we published publicly were the two-factor authentication numbers, both for privileged users and non-privileged users. And this is probably one of the most significant things that you can do to enhance cybersecurity, no matter where you are. This is use of the PIV card, sort of layman's terms here. And the percentages on that went up dramatically. In particular, I was pleased with the privileged user number going up. And we're going to stay on that one like crazy, because it's probably of everything the most significant in that sense. We asked agencies to do a number of other things. We didn't publish the results publicly on that. Part of the reason is, you know, you could use that chart and sort of say, oh, well, here's where I ought to go attack next, kind of thing. You look for the weakest link and so on. So, you know, we're trying to get everybody to a much higher level. One of the things you mentioned is the indicators of compromise. So there are, just call them digital fingerprints that get left by people who do cyber attacks. And you can catalog those fingerprints, and then you can scan your environment and look for evidence of those fingerprints. And we asked all agencies to be more proactive in their scanning for those digital fingerprints. In any kind of scan, if you're doing it right, you're going to come up with some false positives. If you come up with nothing, you probably aren't being intrusive enough or inspecting closely enough. And so I think the chart you're referring to, early on we saw some hits where you go, oh, you know, there's a big problem here. And then when you go look closer, you find out, in fact, that these are false positives. So it's kind of a good news story, but it doesn't feel good the first time you look at the number. You go, oh, crap, you know, we got a big problem here. But if you're a veteran of this, you realize, you know, this is just the sort of path that you're going to go through. And so we're keeping that up. We're continuing to do the scans. We're reducing the number of system administrators across the board. And I feel really good about that. We didn't publicly report on that number, but it's gone down nicely. We asked people to patch for critical vulnerabilities. That number got significantly better. And across the board, every measure that we can make got significantly better during the sprint. And so now our objective is we're going to stay on all that. We also asked agencies to look at their high-value assets, make sure that the protections that we have in place are adequate. Those reviews are ongoing, and as you alluded, this is really a marathon, and that was just a sort of warm-up exercise for the hard work that we're going to have to continue to do.
And I think, by and large, the people I've talked to about the sprint were saying, well, good. You know, they were very pleased to see OMB really coming out more aggressive. And again, because of the marathon, how do you keep it going? You talked about you're going to keep on certain things, system administrators, privileged users. How do you do that? Because the sprint's over, people tend to go, oh, you know, I'm done. How do you continue the longer journey?
Yeah, so we have our cyberstat reviews that we're continuing to do with the agencies. We're inspecting for all of these things that were in the sprint plus other things. And so that will be ongoing. The PMC is going to stay focused on this. Now that they've gotten educated on the number, they're laser focused on it. The chief of staff is asking about it regularly, so that helps. The inspectors general are looking at it in their reports. That helps. GAO is looking at it in their reports, and that helps. So, you know, we may have created some work for people because especially the IGs and the GAOs, you know, now have, you know, new numbers to report and new things to do when they go in and look at agencies. We gave them kind of a roadmap of things to specifically go look at, and I hope they do.
All right, let's open it back up to audience questions. I just got the 15-minute hook, meaning I've got 15 minutes left. The microphone's coming.
Good morning, Tony. For the past few years, especially the past year or two, the private sector has picked up the discussions and the research on the Internet of Things, and the federal government, many programs also involved within the domains of Internet of Things, such as DOT's joint programs on smart cards and so on and so forth. And if those, the IoTs, and will be materialized down the road, and not only because of the large demand for the IP address space to support that IoT monitors and the sensors and or at least the consolidators, I mean, concentrators and the connectors of those IoT devices. So IPv6 will be the fundamental foundation to support the next generation of Internet. From your perspective, does the federal government need to have some kind of a policies at this tipping point in terms of IoT?
I think IPv6 is a really interesting challenge. If you'd asked me 5 years ago or 10 years ago how soon we were going to need IPv6, I would have given you a wrong answer. I thought we would have gotten there much quicker than we have. And so I fear that the answer I'm going to give you now is also the wrong answer. But I think we need to get there, I think, for a whole lot of reasons. IPv6 is important. I like the security model that's possible in IPv6 that's much harder to do in IPv4. It's not just about address space. It's about a whole host of things that I think IPv6 brings value. But, you know, to be honest, I've not found the single lever, the tipping point that says, here's what's going to, you know, take us over the brink. And I wish there was an easy lever, because I think if we got there, I think we'd find some things a lot easier to do. But I'm still looking for it, to be honest. And, you know, we'll do what we can to promote it and make sure it's real. But I'll tell you from the supplier side, when I was at VMware and at Microsoft and I would go ask about it, you know, the answer I got from our product teams was, hey, the government's the only, you know, organization, the only customer that's really asking about this. And I think in reality, until the private sector says we need IPv6 somehow, I think it's going to be a harder battle than it otherwise should be. We got our part to do, but there's more.
We should put this on the calendar. The government's ahead of the private sector on this one.
They are.
Please,
they
put
are.
This on the calendar.
Seriously.
Yeah. Question.
Morning. Zach Noble with FCW. I just was wondering if you could circle back to the 80% figure on O&M.
Mm-hmm.
What is the more precise answer?
I don't want to give you the precise answer today because we're doing the data collection right now and it'll be out in, you know, a couple of weeks. But I'll tell you the trend from the preliminary data I've seen looks like it's headed the wrong way, and I don't like that a bit. So, but I don't want to give you a wrong answer today.
So when that number does come out, I'm guessing it's going to be public?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will something come with that, for instance, a strategy, a plan, an idea, a policy, or is that not necessarily one and the same?
Well, in the same time frame, we'll talk about what we plan to do. Whether it's at exactly the precise same moment, I don't want to speculate at this point. But a
bunch of us reporters want to know if
sure.
The new policy is coming.
Yeah.
Give us a sense of what you and Ann are working on regularly or irregularly, I guess.
Sure. Well, the couple of big initiatives are, you know, much better category management, particularly on commodity IT kinds of things. And there have been several attempts at this over the years, but I think Ann's really got it nailed on this time around, and I'm very excited about some of the work that we're doing in that space because I think there's a real big opportunity there. you know, that's one. Particularly software, big, you know, an increasing amount of the spend that the federal government has is on software. You know, if you looked at software versus hardware ratio, it's, you know, really started to grow significantly. There's an opportunity to do more services instead of, you know, buy licenses, you know, buy more software as a service, and I'm excited about that and the flexibility and agility that that could provide. So, you know, those are some of the big ones that I think are pretty exciting.
Let me start by saying ask the CIO, my one shameless plug, federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. You can listen to it online or on the air. You can always find it online. And Tony Scott can be found at omb.gov, just in case you need that address. And Mike Schmoyer, thank you very much for inviting us. Tony, thank you for your time. Thank you for being a great audience.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.